Chapter 8. Antibiotic Resistance. Ever since the introduction of antibiotics, bacterial resistance has been an issue. However, it is not until recently that this issue has become one of major importance, attracting the attention of the World Health Organization, policymakers, and politicians. The essential reason for the change is that we are exhausting our arsenal of new antibiotics. Many pharmaceutical companies are now reluctant to invest in new antibiotics, for while there is no shortage of antibacterial compounds, the vast majority of them would fail current safety standards. The problem was perceived to be driven by the gram-positive bacteria, such as MRSA, but actually the acute crisis is the continued capability to treat infections caused by gram-negative bacteria. Mutations in the bacterial chromosome. Bacterial infections are composed of literally millions of individual cells. These may be in a liquid environment, such as the blood or urine, or perhaps more likely congregated at a focus of infection. These bacteria are not really individual cells, but as we have discussed, they form a colony of cells with largely an identical set of genes. The survival of the colony requires cooperation between the individual cells and the sacrifice of the majority so that the gene pool can continue to exist. The simplest form of resistance comes from the ability of mutations to occur within genes. This has an average frequency of approximately 1 in 10 to the power of 7 bacterial divisions for any single gene. Thus, within 1 billion bacteria, which make such a colony, there might be 100 bacteria that have undergone spontaneous mutation in a specific gene, and this mutation may confer resistance to a specific antibiotic. When this population is treated with the antibiotic, the vast majority of the bacteria, all but the 100 with the mutation, are inhibited or killed, but the mutants are able to prosper. They start dividing, and soon replace the original infection site with their progeny. Mutations occur during DNA replication prior to bacterial division, which means it is theoretically possible to have a population of bacteria with no resistant mutants when antibiotic treatment begins. However, if the concentration of antibiotic is insufficient, DNA replication will continue and mutants can form. This type of mutational resistance is the reason why doses of antibiotic have to exceed a concentration threshold to prevent the mutants surviving. This has more recently been described as the mutant prevention concentration. Once a single mutation has occurred, and the resistant bacteria have taken over the infection site, it is possible for a second mutation to occur by the same process, giving an even higher degree of resistance, and the progeny of this double mutant will divide and then take over the population. The gene encoding the target for a given antibiotic is usually where the mutations take place. For instance, the GYRA gene encodes a subunit of the enzyme DNA gyrase to which the antibacterial drug ciprofloxacin binds. Sequential mutations in the GYRA gene produce a DNA gyrase molecule that binds ciprofloxacin far less tightly and thus confers resistance. The original GYRA gene encodes a protein with a structure that has evolved over an eon, and presumably this has resulted in the most efficient structure for the role it performs. While the mutations still allow the original role to occur, it may well do so less efficiently than the non-mutated protein. This means that there is an efficiency cost for the bacterium to carry the mutation, and often these bacteria divide more slowly in the absence of antibiotics than the bacteria without the mutant. This results in pressure, once the antibiotic has been removed, for reverse or back mutations to occur, and this is often seen. Based on this assumption, strategies to overcome bacterial resistance have restricted or banned certain antibiotics to reverse the development of resistance. However, back mutations are not the only mutations that can occur under these circumstances. Mutations can occur in other sites in the genome, which improve the division rate. These are called compensatory mutations. The bacterium retains its resistance mutations and is also able to decrease the cost that these mutations have caused. Some strains of bacteria are able to pass into transient hypermutator state. Effectively, this means that mutations will occur at a much higher frequency than 1 in 10 to the power of 7 bacterial divisions, maybe an increase of 1,000-fold. Whereas this could be an advantage in a situation where the bacteria are likely to be challenged with antibiotics, this mutation rate will occur in all genes producing disadvantageous mutations at least as often as in those giving an advantage. Disadvantageous mutations are almost always lethal, so the hypermutator state is often precarious for a bacterial population, and they often revert into their normal state. The increased mutation frequency is found to be a permanent feature in some bacteria that have become resistant to many antibiotics, and is thought to contribute to their multi-resistant character. Although mutation has been crucial to the development of all resistance mechanisms at some point, mutations emerging in the chromosomes of bacteria treated with antibiotics are a surprisingly rare form of resistance. Plasmids and mobile structures. The Japanese were the first to notice that some bacteria became resistant not to just one antibiotic, but to 4 at the same time. This could not be explained by chromosomal mutations, as it would have required a mutation frequency of 1 in 10 to the power of 28 bacterial cell divisions, producing a mass of bacteria greater than that of the moon. Clearly this did not happen, and the resistance genes were found to have been imported en bloc by a plasmid. These circular molecules of DNA are independent of the bacterial chromosome and have their own replication origin. The plasmids conferring resistance in clinical bacteria usually replicate at the same time as the bacterial chromosome, so that the bacterium has approximately 2 to 5 copies of the plasmid. They have the genetic machinery that allows them to transfer from one bacterium to another. This is actually an extremely complex process and requires approximately 25 genes, but it allows the plasmid to pass from one strain to another or to other, often quite different, bacteria. Bacteria have evolved a defense mechanism to protect themselves from unlimited transfers of incoming DNA. They produce restriction endonucleases that cut and degrade incoming DNA, and the plasmid has to overcome these enzymes in order to survive in the new bacterium. The closer the new host is to the old one, the less restriction will occur. These restriction endonucleases are able to recognize specific short sequences of DNA, and as a byproduct of this capability, they are now a crucial tool in many molecular biological laboratory procedures. Chromosomal resistance genes are usually under a repression system so that they are not activated, whereas those on plasmids are usually maximally expressed to give the highest levels of resistance continuously. Re-examination of some of the earliest bacteria ever identified shows that the plasmids themselves have been present for a long time, though the presence of resistance genes is for the most part a recent development. The genes conferring resistance are often clustered together on plasmids, indicating that there is a preferred location. This gives a clue as to how they were captured by the plasmid. Bacterial DNA is littered with elements known as insertion sequences. These are relatively short, about 700 to 2500 nucleotide base pairs long, mobile elements of DNA that can move from one area of DNA to another. At the extremities of the insertion sequence are inverted repeats, and between these there are genes that encode enzymes facilitating movement of the element. Similar insertion sequences can often align themselves closely together on the same sequence of DNA. When this happens, the whole region of DNA, including the 2 insertion sequences and the region in between, can be moved. If there are genes between the insertion sequences, in this case resistance genes, this composite element is known as a transposon. Often transposons insert into specific sites within DNA, and this is commonly the case in plasmids. By the successive introduction of resistance genes located in transposons into a particular location within the plasmid DNA, a cluster of resistance genes forms. Often the structure of the original insertion sequences of the early transposons is disrupted by further transposition events, bringing in new resistance genes. This fixes the early resistance genes in the plasmids and prevents them being transposed out of the plasmids. Insertion sequences can, in theory, surround and pick up any gene in a transposon. However, selection plays an important role, and the reason why we find clusters of resistance genes is because antibiotic usage has selected the plasmids which have particular resistance gene combinations. Transposons, along with plasmids, provide a symbiotic relationship with the host bacteria. They carry accessory genes, resistance in this case, that are beneficial but not usually essential for the survival of the organisms. If they are lost, the bacterial population could still survive. Often, however, the exposure to antibiotics is so great that it is more beneficial for the bacterium to carry the resistance gene in the chromosome than on a plasmid. Transposons carrying resistance genes are increasingly found located in the bacterial chromosome. It could be argued that this is not the evolutionary endpoint for resistance genes, because many multi-resistant bacteria that are spreading clonally through the clinical population retain their resistance genes on identical plasmids. It is likely that there is a match between certain plasmids and bacteria. Plasmids, as extrachromosomal DNA, do provide an energy drain on the resources of the cell. In some successful cases, where a plasmid has established itself in a particular pathogen, the cost has been ameliorated by mutations in the plasmid and the host DNA, ensuring that this becomes a favoured combination. There is a further advantage, as not every bacterial cell within the population needs to carry the plasmid, though they often do, because if the bacteria are suddenly challenged with antibiotics, then only those with the plasmid survive. The capture of resistance genes by insertion sequences is a relatively inefficient process and does not alone explain the rapid acquisition of resistance genes by transposons and plasmids. Within each are often found integrons. These are short DNA sequences that can capture genes by encoding an integrase enzyme. The gene, INT1, encoding integrase, is closely linked to an attachment site, ATT, into which the captured genes are inserted, and a promoter from which the inserted gene is expressed. The gene cassettes that integrons capture often do not confer resistance, but antibiotic usage ensures that many of those integrons identified in clinical bacteria do carry resistance genes. Mechanisms of resistance. Mutation of the target of an antibiotic is not an option for plasmid-mediated resistance. The resistance mechanism has to be dominant, and is usually, though not always, the result of a single gene. Almost all bacteria possess genes encoding enzymes that export often unwanted metabolites. When encoded by the chromosome, these efflux pumps are usually under strict repressed control, and are activated only when needed. Some of them are able to efflux antibiotics, thus providing a low level of resistance as they export the drug faster than it can enter. Some plasmids have acquired genes for efflux and are able to confer resistance to antibiotics such as tetracycline. The efficiency is restricted by the concentration of antibiotic outside the cell, and as more is being imported, the efflux pump is soon overwhelmed. Thus they give relatively low levels of resistance, and are in many cases just the first line of defence. Clinical concentrations of antibiotics are high, and the resistance mechanisms must match this. The most widespread mechanism is inactivation of the antibiotic, either by the enzymic destruction of the antibiotic, or by the addition of a chemical group to the antibiotic so that it is no longer taken up or recognised as an active antibiotic. Enzymic destruction is exemplified by just one enzyme, the beta-lactamase. Many bacteria have genes encoding them on their chromosome, but in clinical bacteria, the infiltration of beta-lactamases has been on plasmids, and there are more than 1,000 identified in clinical bacteria. The enzyme attacks the beta-lactam ring, which is crucial to the function of penicillins, cephalosporins, and carbapenems. Beta-lactamases are a prime example of convergent evolution, as four distinct molecular classes, A to D, have been identified. Class A is derived from the chromosomal beta-lactamases of gram-positive bacteria, and has evolved primarily to confer resistance to penicillins. Class C is from the chromosomal beta-lactamases of gram-negative bacteria, and its primary target is the cephalosporins. The class D beta-lactamases are chromosomal beta-lactamases of one genus of gram-negative bacteria, Acinetobacter. All three classes have the same basic mechanism of action, using a serine residue for their enzyme catalysis, though their overall structures are completely different. Class B beta-lactamases have a different mechanism of action. They are metalloenzymes, so use a zinc ion to catalyse the destruction of the antibiotic, and they are particularly effective against the carbapenems. The origins of this class of beta-lactamase are unknown. The class A beta-lactamases were transported from their gram-positive origins to the plasmids of gram-negative bacteria. The most prevalent is called TEM1, after an Athenian girl, Temenira, who provided the bacteria from which it was first identified. This beta-lactamase was unknown before the introduction of ampicillin, and has now become the most widespread antibiotic resistance mechanism in the world, so much so that a quarter of the population carry commensal bacteria containing this resistance gene. The TEM1 beta-lactamase provided a very efficient resistance to the penicillins, but was largely unaffected by the cephalosporins. Therefore, there was a massive rise in the number of new cephalosporins capable of overcoming this resistance. However, in 1982, there was an outbreak in a neonatal unit in Liverpool, England. The causative bacterium, Klebsiella oxytoca, was treated with the cephalosporin ceftazidime until the bacterium became resistant. The TEM1 beta-lactamase that it was carrying had mutated at position 164 with the effect of opening the active site and allowing ceftazidime to be destroyed. Once this first mutation had taken place, other mutations soon followed, until well over 100 different enzymes all derived from the original TEM molecules had been found, and virtually all cephalosporins could now be resisted. These are known as extended-spectrum beta-lactamases, or ESBLs. A class A beta-lactamase, similar to TEM, though far less common, is SHV1. It has the same activity against penicillins, but also started to mutate until it also produced over 100 ESBLs. This had the effect of not only reducing the usage of cephalosporins, but also restricting their further development as new antibiotics. Actually, the proportion of ESBLs based on TEM and SHV has declined, and a new group of class A enzymes, the CTXM ESBLs, is the largest group, CTX standing for cefotaxime, the cephalosporin antibiotic that is the primary target of these enzymes. Unlike the plasmid origin of TEM and SHV, the CTXM enzymes derive from chromosomal beta-lactamases of Clivera species, which are closely related to Escherichia coli. There have been at least 5 distinct subgroups of CTXM enzymes derived from Clivera species. The subgroups are closely related to each other, but the enzymes within each one are very similar. The 2 most widely distributed CTXM ESBLs in clinical bacteria throughout the world are CTXM15, derived from Clivera ascobata via a transposon and plasmid, and CTXM14, derived from Clivera georgiana. Cephalosporin resistance led to a greater clinical reliance on the carbapenems, which are largely immune to the ESBLs. Soon, plasmid-encoded class B beta-lactamase carbapenem resistance emerged from a host of closely related beta-lactamases, KPC, GES, IMP, VIM, SPM, GIM, and SIM. However, since it emerged in 2008, the unrelated plasmid class B beta-lactamase NDM1 soon dominated, causing concern as this has a broad spectrum against all beta-lactam antibiotics, and its gene has the ability to migrate into many bacterial species. The prototypes of the beta-lactamases found in clinical bacteria did not evolve entirely during the time that we started using antibiotics. They were initially defence mechanisms, known as secondary metabolites, used by soil bacteria to gain an advantage against other bacteria and fungi, such as Penicillium notatum. These bacteria would never have survived without these enzymes, and their genes have then been transported to clinical bacteria by successive and hitherto unknown interactions between environmental and clinical bacteria. In the latter, mutations have been selected by successive challenges with different antibiotics. Many resistance mechanisms derive from the bacteria that originally produced the antibiotic, because although it destroys other bacteria in the immediate environment, it runs the risk of killing itself. It had to evolve a defence system, and an effective method is modification of the enzyme that produces the final antibiotic. If this gene is duplicated and then mutates, then the resultant enzyme may bind the antibiotic and attach a functional group to it to render it ineffective. This is the basis of aminoglycoside modification. There are three enzymic groups: N-acetyltransferases, AAC, catalyzing acetyl-CoA dependent acetylation of an amino group; O-adenyl transferases, ANT, catalyzing ATP dependent adenylation of a hydroxyl group; and O-phosphotransferases, APH, catalyzing ATP-dependent phosphorylation of a hydroxyl group, effectively adding an acetyl, adenyl or phosphate group, respectively, to various positions on the molecule, providing high-level resistance. There are over 50 of these enzymes, mainly encoded on plasmids, and one has emerged, AAC6-IBCR, which has the ability to add both an acetyl group and efflux fluoroquinolones, a very versatile enzyme. Destruction and modification are the common resistance mechanisms for antibiotics derived from natural sources. The bacteria face a greater challenge when the drug has no counterpart in nature. Bacteria would never have previously been exposed to the synthetic antibacterials trimethoprim and sulfonamides. However, high-level resistance emerged quickly, encoded by genes introduced on plasmids. Unlike the previous resistance mechanisms, the plasmids encoded an additional target enzyme, a dihydrofolate reductase in the case of the trimethoprim resistance, and a dihydroteroate synthetase for sulfonamide resistance. The additional target enzymes could still perform the task of the chromosomal enzyme, but they were far less susceptible to inhibition by the antibiotics. Therefore, they bypass the antibiotic's inhibition of the chromosomal enzyme. Although this can produce very high levels of resistance, an increase of up to 10,000-fold, it is a fairly inefficient method of resistance, as the bacterium has to expend energy to produce two enzymes, one of which is ineffective as it is inhibited. This mechanism can only be employed when there are relatively few original enzyme molecules produced by the cell, up to just 10 in these two cases. Some dihydrofolate reductases originated from mutations in chromosomal enzymes of related species, giving low levels of resistance. However, the process of sequential mutation does not explain the rapid emergence of high-level resistance, as these genes must have been present before the drugs were introduced. Some resistant dihydrofolate reductases came from unknown sources, which are unlikely to have been bacterial in origin. Since the discovery of these bypass mechanisms in 1974, it was thought that trimethoprim and sulfonamide resistances were the only examples. In the 1990s, there was a sharp rise in vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus, VRE, strains, a problem as vancomycin was the only effective drug. Vancomycin is a natural product, and it might be expected that the resistance mechanism would be destruction of the antibiotic. However, it is much more complex, and is by far the most sophisticated antibiotic-resistant mechanism found so far. The binding site of the antibiotic is the D-alanyl-D-alanine dipeptide at the end of the cross-linking pentapeptide of the peptidoglycan polymer of the cell wall. During the cross-linking process, the bond between the two alanine residues of D-alanyl-D-alanine is broken, the terminal D-alanine is removed, and the cross-link occurs with the remaining D-alanine residue. The resistance mechanism exploits this excision. Normal synthesis of the peptidoglycan requires the ligation, binding, of two D-alanine molecules to form D-alanyl-D-alanine. The resistance mechanism comprises three main genes. The first reverses this reaction so that any D-alanyl-D-alanine formed by the cell will be converted back to two molecules of D-alanine, VAN-X. A second enzyme converts the product of glucose metabolism, pyruvate, into D-lactate, VAN-H, and a third enzyme ligates the D-lactate to D-alanine to produce D-alanyl-D-lactate, VAN-A. The latter is then used, instead of D-alanyl-D-alanine, in the formation of the pentapeptide in the synthesis of peptidoglycan. Vancomycin does not readily bind to D-alanyl-D-lactate, and so the cross-linking of peptidoglycan is not inhibited. When the cross-linking occurs, the bond between the D-alanine and the D-lactate is broken, the D-lactate is removed, and the cross-linking uses the D-alanine as before. So the composition of the final molecule is exactly the same as before, only the means of production is different. Unlike most plasmid-encoded resistance mechanisms, vancomycin resistance is not the result of a single gene product, but takes over the cell's normal synthetic machinery. Such a sophisticated mechanism of resistance could not have evolved in the 70 years that vancomycin has been used clinically. Actually, very similar mechanisms have been found in Streptomyces toyakiensis and Amygdalotopsis orientalis. Despite its name, vanco, meaning of unknown origin, vancomycin was originally discovered in a strain of Amygdalotopsis orientalis, an actinomycete isolated from a soil sample in Borneo. The presence of three genes, in the same orientation as those found in plasmids in clinical Enterococcus faecium, suggests that they evolved in the species producing vancomycin in order to protect itself from the antibiotic it was manufacturing. These genes were possibly captured by Streptomyces toyakiensis, another soil inhabitant, in order to protect this species against the drug. Antiseptics and biocides. Most attention is directed at antibiotic resistance, but actually we use a raft of other antibacterial chemicals, which we classify as biocides, and subdivide as disinfectants and antiseptics. The difference between the latter two is often the concentration used. Disinfectants are used at high concentrations, which can be toxic to man, whereas antiseptics are used at much weaker concentrations, as they are often applied to the extremities of the body. Should we be concerned about resistance to these compounds? The concentrations of disinfectants used clinically are often more than 1,000 times the concentration required to inhibit or kill the bacteria, and they are usually indiscriminate, so will kill all microorganisms. Although resistance to these compounds does exist, the level is far lower than the concentrations that bacteria are likely to encounter. Problems emerge if the disinfectant is used incorrectly, wrong concentration, inappropriate application, and so on. If a disinfectant is not removed completely after use and residues remain, resistant bacteria may proliferate. Similarly, the efficacy of the disinfectant can be considerably weakened if there is a large amount of organic matter, such as blood, present. The case is less clear with the antiseptics and those biocides that we incorporate into everyday objects, such as cutting boards. Weaker biocides tend to be more discriminatory, not just against bacteria, but also the type of bacteria that they are able to inhibit. The antiseptics generally have more difficulty disrupting the double membrane and thicker cell wall of gram-negative bacteria than they do with gram-positive bacteria. The concentrations used are often, but not always, higher than those required to kill the bacteria. Resistance genes have emerged, and these generally confer resistance through an efflux pump. One widely used group of antiseptics is the quaternary ammonium compounds, which are particularly effective against gram-positive bacteria. Resistance genes, QAC, encoding efflux pumps, have emerged, sometimes in multiple copies. These genes are often found in MRSA, closely linked to the genes that confer antibiotic resistance, which leads to the speculation as to whether antiseptic use can select for antibiotic resistance. This has been further compounded with the discovery that Acinetobacter baumannii, a serious hospital pathogen, can have up to four copies of the gene. In this case, they were found closely linked to genes conferring heavy metal resistance. The presence of the QAC and other resistance genes is not always associated with decreased susceptibility to antiseptics. This may in part be due to the fact that we do not have clear procedures for measuring antiseptic susceptibility, such as we do for antibiotics. Furthermore, antiseptic preparations often contain mixtures of compounds, including surface active agents, to promote the effect of the main component. However, it may simply be due to the fact that antiseptic resistance genes are not really what we suppose them to be, and are actually selected by exposure to other compounds. The close association of QAC genes with heavy metal resistance genes in Acinetobacter baumannii suggests that these genes may have been selected when the bacterium was in the environment before it became a clinical pathogen. Clinical resistance. Microbiologists measure bacterial susceptibility by observing the ability of the antibiotic to inhibit the bacteria when growing on agar in a petri dish. The simplest method is to spread a bacterial culture, which has been isolated from an infection, on the surface of agar in a petri dish. The agar contains nutrients that allow the bacteria to grow. On the bacterial lawn are placed small circular discs made of filter paper containing fixed and accurate amounts of antibiotics. The antibiotic diffuses out of the disc into the agar. After the petri dish has been incubated, usually at 37 degrees Celsius, normal human body temperature, the bacteria will have grown over the surface of the agar, except around the discs of antibiotics, where there will be a circular zone of no growth as the antibiotic remains in sufficient concentration to inhibit the bacteria. The more susceptible the bacteria are to the antibiotic, the larger the zone. The size of the zone is usually correlated with the sizes of zones for the same antibiotic against control susceptible bacteria. The more resistant the bacteria, the smaller the zone, so that very resistant bacteria may have no zone at all. Disc susceptibility is a fast and reasonably accurate determination of bacterial susceptibility, but it is not easy to quantify. In order to achieve this, the minimum inhibitory concentration of the antibiotic has to be determined, usually by placing the bacteria onto agar in petri dishes containing increasing concentrations, usually in doubling increments of antibiotic. After incubation, the lowest concentration able to prevent visible growth on the agar is known as the minimum inhibitory concentration, or MIC. This is a very accurate determination of bacterial susceptibility. There is increasing interest in predicting susceptibility and resistance by the genes that the bacterium carries. These do not involve culture of the bacterium, but rather amplification of its DNA by the polymerase chain reaction, PCR. It is possible to identify not only specific genes, but also whether they are being expressed. Depending on the combination of expressed genes in a particular species of bacteria, it may be possible to predict the resistance profile of the bacteria. The advantages of DNA-based techniques would be the speed and reduced cost at which a result can be obtained. The use of DNA-based techniques may seem fanciful, not least because they extrapolate in order to give a prediction. However, the culture-based techniques are also, in essence, just predictions. So what do we mean by clinical resistance? Microbiologists are keen to report reduced susceptibility to an antibiotic or biocide, but whether this can be translated into the failure of an antibiotic to cure an infection is a different matter. According to the old National Committee for Clinical Laboratory Standards, NCCLS definition, the implication of the susceptible category implies that an infection due to the strain may be appropriately treated with the dosage of the antimicrobial agent recommended for the type of infection and infecting species. Thus, the converse is true, that a bacterium is not clinically resistant if the organism can still be controlled by clinically achievable levels of the drug. There is a good example of this with Streptococcus pneumoniae. This bacterium can become resistant to penicillin by alterations in the target site proteins, known as the penicillin binding proteins. Depending on the alteration, These generally can confer either a moderate or major increase in resistance to penicillin. A fully susceptible bacterium may have an MIC of 0.03 milligrams per litre, whereas a moderate increase would raise this to 1 milligram per litre, and a major increase to 16 milligrams per litre. The concentrations of penicillin reaching the lung should be in excess of 1 milligram per litre, so bacteria with this level of intermediate resistance may still be susceptible to treatment. Indeed, this has been recommended in some cases. On the other hand, the high-level resistance should be able to overcome the clinical levels of antibiotic. Susceptibility levels of an antibiotic determined in the laboratory, in vitro, have rarely been correlated with the clinical efficacy, in vivo. There is a variety of reasons why a given antibiotic may behave differently in different patients. The heavier the patient, the less antibiotic may reach the site of infection as the antibiotic spreads through the body. No account is normally taken of patient size at prescribing. Thus, the antibiotic may cure the same infection in a lighter patient, but not in one who is obese. Also, infections behave slightly differently, and each patient's immune status differs. Thus, we can only make broad assumptions that as a bacterium becomes more resistant, as measured in vitro, it is less likely to be successfully treated in vivo. Microbiologists continuously monitor the MICs of an antibiotic for the target bacterial populations. They usually determine the concentration of antibiotic that would inhibit 50% of the population, known as the MIC sub 50. This is the median of the sensitivity, and when this figure starts to rise, it means that half the bacteria isolated are showing reductions in susceptibility. A more sensitive parameter is to determine the concentration that inhibits 90% of the bacteria, known as the MIC sub 90. This starts to rise as 10% of the bacteria show reduced susceptibility. Decisions are made about the continued use of antibiotics based on information such as this. Once 10% of the bacteria are showing the emergence of resistance, when previously all had been sensitive, concern might be raised. When the MRSA outbreak was at its worst in British hospitals in 1998, 40% of all Staphylococcus aureus isolations were MRSA. Clearly, this level of resistant bacteria is far too high. It is important to note how these figures are reached. The procedure of monitoring the levels of antibiotic resistance is called surveillance. The difficulty is that the proportion of resistance will depend on which bacteria are entered into the data. For example, a hospital laboratory may measure the incidences of resistance in a particular bacterial species from lung infections. These may be completely different from the resistance levels in the same species at another site of infection. In addition, the hospital laboratory may refer a proportion of its difficult bacteria to a reference laboratory. The resistance data from the reference laboratory will show a higher proportion of resistance, as the population examined has already been selected because of its resistance. The greatest discrepancies are likely to come in general practice. The majority of infections treated empirically with antibiotics are in general practice, that is to say, without reference to sensitivity tests. If this treatment is successful, the patient will not return, and in most cases, it might be assumed that the causative bacteria were susceptible. Only if the infection does not respond to treatment might a specimen be taken and then sent to a laboratory. Suppose these cases account for 10% of all infections, and 50% of these were found to be resistant. The surveillance data from the laboratory would show that 50% of the causative bacteria were antibiotic resistant, whereas the true figure might be less than 10%. Surveillance is not epidemiology. Only if every patient with a particular infection provided a specimen could we accurately assess the true level of resistance. Despite these minutiae, there is no doubt that clinical bacteria are becoming more resistant and therapy is threatened. During the first 40 years of antibiotic use, resistance was a problem, but not sufficient to force the removal of individual antibiotics from clinical use. By the 1980s, antibiotics alone were being used to control bacterial numbers in many hospitalized patients with suppressed immune systems. However, this placed an intolerable burden on the current antibiotics. It propelled the emergence and spread of bacteria which had a predisposition towards multiple antibiotic resistance. At first, it was the gram-positive bacteria, such as MRSA and VRE. At the time, most antibiotics in hospitals had targeted gram-negative bacteria. Antibiotics active against gram-positive bacteria were introduced, resulting in the emergence of multi-resistant gram-negative pathogens, and soon bacteria emerged that became resistant to almost all antibiotics. The challenge that multi-resistant gram-negative bacteria causes is much greater than it was in the 1980s, for, as with antiseptic treatment, gram-negative bacteria are more difficult to treat with antibiotics due to their thicker cell walls. It is proving extremely difficult to find new drugs that will be sufficiently selective to control these bacteria, yet be safe enough for systemic use in humans. There are significant resistance problems to the last successful anti-gram-negative antibiotics, ciprofloxacin, the cephalosporins, and the carbapenems, especially in hospitals. Even common hospital pathogens, such as Klebsiella pneumoniae, are becoming resistant to them all. As with MRSA, we have had to fall back on an old toxic antibiotic, colistin. Most multi-resistant gram-negative bacteria are sensitive to colistin, but slowly resistance is beginning to develop. If it becomes firmly established, we will have almost no viable antibiotics to treat multi-resistant gram-negative bacteria. This is likely to be a situation that is only acute in hospitals and among the immunocompromised patients. However, all hospital procedures need a risk assessment, and if the risk of an untreatable infection increases for certain procedures, especially through elective surgery, then fewer operations will be feasible. Clonality of resistant bacteria. Almost all the major multi-resistant species of bacteria are not simply the sensitive bacteria that have become resistant. Rather, our use of antibiotics has selected out strains that have a predisposition towards resistance. MRSA is a good example of this. There is more than 20% variation within the genomes of sensitive Staphylococcus aureus. The species has a core genome of around 80%, with differences primarily found in the variable region. When the genomes of MRSA were sequenced, it was found that this diversity was lost. So what we have been witnessing with these multi-resistant bacteria is the influence of external pressures, which of course have been the driving force for the evolution of all bacteria. In the case of multi-resistant bacteria in general, and MRSA in particular, the selective capability of antibiotics has provided an opportunity to observe the evolution of these bacteria. Comparison of the genomes of all sequenced strains of MRSA has been analysed with the eBurst software. With this, it is possible to recognise relationships and identify the distances between sequences of individual strains. The MRSA strains are closely related, suggesting that their common ancestry was in the recent past. It is possible to quantify when and how often certain genetic events took place. For example, the distinguishing feature of MRSA is the carriage of the MEK gene that confers methicillin resistance. It appears to have migrated to MRSA strains on no more than 10 occasions. However, once this gene had migrated, it was not a guarantee of success, as most strains that had captured this gene have not flourished. The MEK gene was first found in sequence type ST250. It was later found in the related complexes of ST8, ST239, and ST247. The complex groups ST39, ST30, and ST36 all contain MRSA. ST36 has been the most successful in the United Kingdom and is clinically known as epidemic E-MRSA16. Other features, many yet unrecognised, have been responsible for the domination of the major MRSA clones we identify today. Similar observations have been made with the evolution of other multi-resistant bacteria, such as Streptococcus pneumoniae and Acinetobacter baumannii. In Streptococcus pneumoniae, the multi-resistant strains fall within specific serogroups, originally identified by their serology, but now by the genomic sequences. Specific serotypes have been successful not only because of their predisposition to resist antibiotics, but also by their pathogenicity. 13 of the most resistant serotypes have been used to make a vaccine, Prevnar 13. The widespread use of this vaccine is expected to control these serotypes. However, there is a suggestion that new, multi-resistant serotypes are emerging to fill the void created by this vaccine. So we may see the impact of an intervention other than an antibiotic on the evolution of these bacteria. Similarly, although there are nearly 100 different types of Acinetobacter baumannii, most of the strains isolated are multi-resistant versions of just a handful of clones, known as the worldwide clones. These clones appear much more successful than the rest. The reason for this is not clear, and they possess genes, currently unknown, that promote their success. Further genomic sequencing may provide this answer in the future. Resistance in the developing world. The introduction of new resistance mechanisms into the clinical population is a relatively rare event, and most of the resistance that we witness is caused by the spread of resistant bacteria. The source of new antibiotic resistance genes is a matter of hot debate. It is known that the incidences of resistance in bacteria from some developing countries are much higher than in the equivalent bacteria in the industrialized world, often caused by poor sanitation, where there is continual infection and reinfection. Faced with this problem, many antibiotics are obtained over the counter without reference to a healthcare worker, a practice only recently outlawed in some countries of the European Union. These may either be obtained in an insubstantial number of doses, or the drugs themselves may be of poor quality, only containing a small proportion of the stated doses of antibiotic. In either case, the bacteria causing the infection will often be treated with sub-inhibitory concentrations, creating a powerful selection environment for resistance development. The problem will be exacerbated as the patients are likely to be undernourished, which will compromise the immune system and make it even more difficult for the antibiotic to control the infection. Resistance in animal bacteria. We have discussed how ruminants use bacteria in their gastrointestinal tract to break down the cellulose of grass and release the nutrients within. As feed for animals was modified and became richer in nutrients, the need for these bacteria decreased. However, bacteria are still present and prosper on the new feed, reducing the amount available for the host animal. In order to combat this, animals were given sub-inhibitory doses of antibiotics to suppress the growth of these commensal bacteria. These antibiotics are referred to as growth promoters, and their use does significantly increase weight gain. However, the use of sub-inhibitory concentrations has a significant impact on the gut microbiota and promotes the development of resistance. In 1969, the Swan Report outlawed the administration of antibiotics used in human medicine as growth promoters. In 2006, the European Union outlawed the use of all growth promoters for fear that their use was leading to antibiotic resistance. In the United States, a ban by the Food and Drug Administration has recently been placed on the use of growth promoters, and their use has declined. The intensive farming of animals, especially poultry, pigs, and fish, leads to rapid transmission of disease from one animal to another. In order to combat this, half the antibiotics used in the United Kingdom are used to treat infections in farm animals. They are, however, used differently from clinical practice. The treatment of human patients, for the most part, is confined to the individual, and measures are taken to prevent cross-infection. This is impossible in a herd, so when one animal is infected, the whole herd is treated prophylactically. This may ensure that the animals of a herd are treated with antibiotics for much of their rearing, a practice not too dissimilar from the use of growth promoters. It is known that many bacteria isolated from animals are resistant to antibiotics, and there is much speculation that these are the source of resistance in human bacteria. There is certainly evidence that multi-resistant individual bacteria, such as Salmonella enterica, serotype Typhimurium, previously Salmonella typhimurium, DT-104, are transferred directly from cattle to humans through contaminated meat. Other Salmonella strains have been reported in eggs, and multi-resistant Campylobacter strains have been found to transmit directly from chickens to humans. These almost always cause infections in the community. The ability of resistance genes to transmit directly to bacteria that cause serious infections in hospital is less clear, and the evidence is often circumstantial. How to overcome resistance? Resistance severely threatens the future of antibiotic use in hospitals. So how do we control resistance without the discovery and introduction of new antibiotics? The short answer is much better management of the antibiotics we have, and this requires rapid identification of not only the pathogen, but also the resistance genes it carries. Molecular biology is almost certainly the answer, and this is addressed in the next chapter. Without rapid diagnosis, most prescribing will remain empirical, and resistance is likely to continue to increase, and will inevitably reverse the current increase we see in average lifespan.